Exhibition number 22333, Rule 14.
Just before we were interrupted on the other side, you were talking about the Japanese strongholds and that sort of thing. Continue.
Yes, well, of course, the landing of Balikpapan was where we landed. We're unopposed. We expected to be heavily repulsed, but we weren't. And we got, I suppose, 200 yards inland, or 200 metres inland, before we first encountered the Japanese. And there they were in their side of the hills, in these caves. Now, I actually never went into a cave because I thought it was dead silly, too risky. But our troops went in several instances. But so far as I know, they never went right into the caves for the simple reason that they weren't ready to throw their lives away. Where we were, I was assistant quartermaster. What had happened was that all our stores and our quartermaster and his crowd were put on a ship, and they were in a convoy that came out of Townsville about the same time as we did. They struck rough weather. They were delayed, and they didn't get into Balikpapan till about 5 weeks after we landed there because of this ship trouble. And of course, I had the job of looking after the battalion as far as the stores and ammunition went. And I selected a position where I'd been given some indication to go by the CO. And I selected that position, and it was only about 40 or 50 yards from about three of these caves. Well, they weren't caves, I suppose you call them caves, entrances into the hillside that the Japs had dug. Well, they hadn't dug them. I believe they'd employed Indian labour, that they'd captured these Indian labour in Singapore and those places, and send them to this Borneo as coolies, and they were soldiers, and it practically killed them there by overwork. There were very, very few of them left when we got there. Most of them had died. But they were used to dig out these hillside holes. And the Japs, they were the defensive position for the Japanese, for any shelling, so all the shelling that went on from these just tremendous armada of ships offshore, the Japanese hardly affected them. They all dug into the side of the hills. Anyhow, what happened was that we set up a position there, and the forward troops moved up. Are you cold?
No, I was just going to turn on a light, though. So we're being reined in at the moment. It's a bit dark outside. Continue what you were saying.
Well, I'd set up a position there, and my job was to look after the forward troops with food and ammunition, mainly ammunition at that stage. And I had no idea where they were, of course. They were advancing up forward, but they knew where the CO had told me to go. And so they had some idea, and from then on, at night time, they found their way back to me and with carriers to take, with the carriers, I say they were their own troops, to take any ammunition and food up forward. And I was stationed back there. Now, three times, I think to be exact, Japanese came out of these holes. So what immediately did I had several men stationed on each hole, and they threw a grenade down the hole. And, of course, the grenade only went off near the entrance. Probably the holes, I heard, went for 80, 100 yards in the underground. And so it didn't affect the Japs in there. But anyhow, it stopped them coming out. And and I had this job of looking after these Japs in these holes in the mountain, and also seeing that the forward troops got their ammunition and their food. Not much food went up, because they were carrying it in their packs, in their haversacks, but the ammunition was the main thing. And during the night, they came in during the night, and once or twice, I think it was, they'd encountered Japanese on the way back and had a firefight and managed to get back all right. One man had got wounded, been wounded, and he, of course, went back to the REP behind me. And anyhow, that carried on. Morning came, and what happened was one of my men, who was still alive a few years ago, spoke to me about it. I'd practically forgotten about it. What it was that I was threatened with a court-martial that morning, because the position I had occupied was the position that the military police were to come ashore and station themselves there. And this major came up and told me that I had to move out because that was their position, the military police were taking over there, and I had to move out. I told them I wouldn't go. It was my job. My CO told me to stay there, and that was my job to stay there. He threatened me with a court-martial if I didn't obey his orders, and I still wouldn't go. And eventually, he went away, and he came back with a captain, and they both then told me, right, you have to get out, or we'll see that you do get out. I said, righto, we'll get out, but I'm taking all my men with me. And they said, right, that's agreed. I said, I'm taking those men with me who are stationed over there on those holes into the mountain, into the hills. And they said, what are they? I said, well, they're Japanese, all in those four holes. I exaggerated a bit. I think there are only three holes. I said, they're Japanese in those four holes, and they're popping out all the time. And the idea is you have to look after them and see that they don't come out. There might be 50 in there, I don't know. I don't know how many are in there, but there might be 50, there might be 100 of them, I just don't know. Well, they talked among themselves, and they said, righto, we'll find somewhere else to go. And I said, well, is there anything to do? I mean, that was the position where my orders were to service the troops who were coming back for food and ammunition for the forward line. And if I moved out, they'd come back in the dark when it was safe to travel, and they wouldn't find me there. They wouldn't know where to look for me. Mm. And so I was quite right in holding that position. I'd forgotten about this till this man reminded me about it a while back, or a few years ago. But anyhow, I stayed there, and I stayed there all through the show, except when I handed over to somebody else, and I went up forward to superintend the companies up there, to look after the companies up more further forward. And I went up there, and at that stage, we were well in control. The Japanese were firing, the CO had told them our troops not to push and suffer casualties except unless they attacked, and that's how we stayed. It was sort of stalemate. The Japs were back there. We saw and pinpointed one Liberator bomber that came down. I was with the troops when that came down. We pinpointed that so that we were able to send out, or not us, another show was able to send out and recover the four men in it. Now, it was, I say, a stalemate. We were there long enough to examine the tremendous equipment that the Japanese had. They had their AK-AK and their mount, their guns were wonderful. They're all electrically controlled. They're ranged down to a few hundred yards, a few feet, and it was wonderfully good equipment. But the lower troops, I call them lower troops, I don't know what you regard them as, they weren't so well armed and looked after because they hadn't been able to get the supplies in. There'd been no ships or anything else coming in, and the Americans had kept them or in a sort of prison for all that time.
So
we came out and we moved up, further up the coast to another position, and there the first thing I saw going along were three tanks. The first time I'd seen tanks in our show since Syria. And these three tanks, I knew one of the chaps in the tank. I spoke to him afterwards. They'd landed from the tank landing craft. They'd gone up a little beach. And then they got behind a little hill. Or wasn't a hill, it was a little embankment. And this chap said to me, he said, "Oh, somebody called out, one of the chaps called out, 'At last, we're taking the tanks into action, our tanks into action.'" And the tanks immediately moved forward, and they hadn't gone 5 yards, and the three of them were knocked out by Japanese artillery. Now, that was the whole story. The Japanese had this artillery in the foothills, and they ranged down to a foot. And when a tank like that came in, there wasn't a case in finding the range, they had a dead shot at it and knocked out three tanks in three shots. And they were the only three tanks I saw there and landed in that area.
So although the Japanese at this stage were not a major threat, they were certainly active.
They were active in these positions because at that stage we hadn't taken those positions. They were still held in there. Where our action took place was that we'd driven where we landed, we'd driven the men there in their main fortifications, and these troops were landing another area further up the coast, looking after another further up the coast, see? We had not done anything about them at that stage. Anyhow, we moved up the coast, and it was right on the very seashore, and one of the first things I saw was this whopping big bunker, this tremendous big mound, all done by, I understood it was done by shovel work, by POWs and coolies. And in that, we found where the Japanese had their torpedoes, their store of torpedoes. Now, four or five of those torpedoes, I went in and had a look at them. Their torpedoes were very good. But what the Japanese had been there, and they known that they had no reinforcements coming to them, and they had to depend on themselves, and they'd mounted these torpedoes on 44-gallon drums alongside them. And the idea was they're going to paddle these torpedoes out till they got near the ships and then do a suicide. Fire these torpedoes close to the ships at night time and torpedo the ships. That was the thing they were thinking about then because they had been isolated for so long. MacArthur had done the right thing. He'd isolated them, and that was it. And we were surprised. There were other torpedoes there waiting to be loaded onto any ship or anything else like that, but of course there were no ships for them to be loaded onto. The Japs hadn't reinforced. Anyhow, we went further up and camped further up, and from there we did our patrols into the hinterland and up the coast, and a few minor scrapped with the Japs were nothing great. And I went up, I suppose, 100 miles inland to the gas fields. And these gas fields had been taken over by the Japanese. But before they'd been taken over, the Dutch or the Anglo mob, I don't know who they were, had dropped things down the gas holes so that they couldn't be used, like any bits of machinery, spanners and things like that. And there, for the first time in my life, I saw a gas field, and we were able to cook. There was gas pipes down in the ground, about half an inch in diameter, with a plug in them, and we were able to light these gas pipes and cook on them, boil on them, cook any meal on them. And we came to a factory that handled where they handled all the little engines, trains they were, little railway engines, about 15 feet long, and oil engines, and they'd been ruined too. But by the time we got there, the people from Macash, I think they were, tradesmen, who come there, and we watched them, we sat down and watched them, how they hammered out bits of sheeting of metal on these gas, using them as oxy welding lamps sort of business, the way these gas spurted out and was lit. And they used it as a forge, and they're hammering out these little things to repair these engines that the Japanese had destroyed. And they got one going while we were there. Anyhow, we went further up, and we went through all this jungle, and I remember the monkeys, first time I'd ever seen them like it. Of course, in New Guinea, we hadn't seen any sign of life like that, but we saw all these monkeys in the trees, and they chattered away to us as we walked underneath, and it was something, just something I'd never seen before, like going into a zoo, I suppose. And all our troops were was wonderful. Anyhow, we went up there and took up a position, and it was the day before my birthday, I think it was, and suddenly we heard the war had finished. And that's the first we'd heard about it, and we saw, cut it out. We don't believe that. And they said, it's true. And we said, I said, oh, we cut it out. They said, it's true. We just heard it. And about 3 or 4 days later, we heard about the atomic bomb. Not where it had dropped. All we heard that an atomic bomb had dropped down in Japan, and the Japanese had surrendered straight away. That's what we heard. And I understood afterwards that they surrendered several weeks after the atomic bomb, the first one had been dropped. But that was the first I heard. Of course, we went mad. We just couldn't believe it after all these years. And there it was. And we, I don't think we had any extra attack at all or anything else. And we immediately turned around and said, righto, the war's over. We don't want no more interest in it. And we marched back.
Were there celebrations? I mean, you were saying we had no celebrations.
We were just out there on a track. We didn't had our ground sheet, and I don't think we had a blanket or anything else.
What did going mad actually mean?
Oh well, we sort of danced and I suppose we threw our arms around each other and just just created a bit of joyful gambling on the green sort of business, and that's how it was. But we were just so relieved, because afterwards, anyhow, I'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Take it on, but that's how it was. And then we turned around and slowly made our way back to the coast to where we were camped. There we formed a very good camp. We had timber men from the south, west of West Australia, who'd worked in timber and logging camps and things like that, and I set up a captured camp with captured material, and a saw bench and an engine and saw made wood and for sheds and everything else. I remember there, one of our chaps, my men died, and I thought, oh good, I'll make a coffin for him, but no, we weren't allowed to make a coffin for him. We had to provide timber for buildings.
Mm.
And anyhow, I saw him buried. I buried him, actually, in a blanket. That's all he was given, no coffin. The Americans had coffins, and they used to put their dead into it and take them away, but we just buried them where they were in the blanket, the way of our war was. Anyhow, we stayed there for quite a while. We visited the lady Mountbatten, and the senior officers went over and met her, and she went for a swim with some of the senior officers. We went for a swim there every night, and the tide was warm as tepid. The water was tepid, warm, the tropics, and we'd have to go out 300 or 400 yards before it became 2 or 3 foot deep. And we used to go out to a Catalina flying boat that had landed there in perfect condition, absolutely perfect condition. But when they landed, it was a forced landing, and it was too shallow, and they strained a spar or something like that. So that flying boat was immediately wiped off. We couldn't understand that. Of course, the Australian Army would have, Australian people would have prepared, you know, repaired it and used it again. But the Yanks just wiped it off. And we went down, one of our chaps got the compass out of it. When I approached it, I remember seeing a little parcel floating on the ground, on the water. And I grabbed it and took it. I thought, oh, this will be good. I took it ashore and a whole lot of little rivets. And I've still got some of those rivets now. But they're aluminium rivets, and they're that light that they floated on water. And I've still got some downstairs now. But that boat just, it was there when we finished, just getting deteriorating.
With the finish of the war, sort of the alleviation of pressure on being attacked, what of actually clearing out the Japanese? There were still Japanese there.
No, we didn't worry about them.
Okay.
Didn't worry about them. We left that to the other troops. And
what were your...
And when we camped there, after about two or three weeks, I can't remember, about 3 weeks it might have been, 2 weeks, where our tents were and the seashore, we were about just above high tide, and we'd be about 60 yards off the shore. We saw this long string of Japanese POWs marching along, guarded by RAAF coast. And one of our officers, I remember it so well, a Japanese was carrying a little bag with his worldly goods in it, and it broke and it dropped and it scattered, and this RAAF man, aircraft and whatever they called it, they weren't aircraft, what they were doing, they enlisted a hell of a lot of RAAF troops to guard their camps and look after their camps. And they were the ones who we used to see playing two up at night in shorts and no shirt, where we had to walk around with full malarial kit on so we wouldn't get bitten by mosquitoes. Anyhow, this guard marching on side used his rifle butt to knock the Japanese back into the line, and we let him pick up positions. One of our officers went out and immediately stopped the whole lot and let this Japanese POW pick up his positions. And this officer told the RAAF man, soldier off well and truly, and said, that's not the way to treat him. And how do you like to be treated like that and that sort of business? And they went up. And anyhow, they formed a camp about 4 miles, 3 miles up, it might have been 3 miles, not far up anyhow, above ours along the coast. We were given the job of going up and inspecting those camps, checking on them. I remember so vividly going up there one morning to do an inspection, and we had to find a bit of fault. They all lined up outside the tents, and we had to find a little bit of fault with them because of the discipline. And I remember just commenting on some little minor thing, very minor, that wouldn't even be noticed now. So I mentioned it, and I saw this officer turn around and speak to the sergeant, chap in charge. The Japanese, in that time, they had their own officers and NCOs in charge. The officer, I don't remember him striking the sergeant or the NCO, but he could have. I didn't see it at that stage. But I saw the sergeant then turn around and strike a corporal, knock him over, slap him on the side of the face. I saw the corporal turn around and slap two other soldiers on the side of the face for this minor thing that I just picked up. If that was their thing, what they had to do was anything indiscipline, they had to pass it down the line, and the person who'd made the mistake, he was the one who got punished. But that's how it was. He got punished pretty severely, I suppose. But that's how it was. But we learned then, we talked about it, and when I went back and told them, they said, that's okay. You still have to find a little bit of fault every time you inspect those things, whether it's in the tent or outside the tent, or whether the soldiers got a button undone or something like that. You had to find a little bit of fault. Otherwise, they thought our discipline was that lax that they could do anything they wanted. And it was passed down the line from the officer to the sergeant down there like a dog.
Given your experience with the Japanese, what was the general feeling towards them now that the war had finished?
We had no idea. What we saw, the first one I spoke to was a RAAF officer, a pilot, a flight lieutenant. He is a brother of one of our OC, one of our troops. Not an NCO, he's actually a batman. My brother, one of our, he had left us after Jan Stanley's, and this officer had been captured, and he'd been badly treated at the start, at the end, but they tried to get him to tell him something he didn't know anything about, and that was how far the coral reefs ran down the side of West Australia. They wanted that information from this officer. They probably wanted from every airman, I don't know. But that was the one thing they wanted from this RAAF officer, how far the reef ran down our western coast. As you probably know, the reefs go right down our coast, except for a few places where we got a harbour. Otherwise, the reefs were right alongside.
But what was the general feeling of the average soldier towards the Japanese soldier now that the war had finished?
Well, in those days, I saw four or five Indians who had been soldiers. They had been used to dug out this thing, and they were walking skeletons. They were a shocking mess. You couldn't believe it. They still walked. That hollow and thing. And that's how it was. We had no idea of how they'd been treating our POWs. We had no idea of the Tarakan Death March or anything like that. We were killed as Jap, because he killed us, and that's how it was. We never took a prisoner, I never asked to take a prisoner. But later on, a Gona or something like that, they were asked in certain cases. Not a Gona, but further south on, saying they were asked to try and get a prisoner for information. But I never heard anything about it. The prisoners that I saw, there were three of them. They came into the hospital in Moresby, where I was in with malaria, after I missed the Gona show. They came in there through. They'd been wounded, slightly wounded, and that was a rather joke, because one of our officers, which I'd been to see him when he'd come in wounded from Gona, and he couldn't see me. I wasn't allowed to see him. He'd been shot through the throat and through both shoulders. Now, this is a bit of a joke, because officer, he was a major. He decorated, and he had a beautiful baritone voice. After he shot through the throat, he could never sing again properly. And when he went to action at Gona, he carried two 45 revolvers on either side that he had obtained from the Japanese, and he retained those. Now, the joke was, if anybody that man hated was a military policeman. He just hated the military policeman, and he wouldn't give one a good day. Anyhow, when he came to hospital, everybody there, all the troops, had malaria or something like that, and they had to give this chap a blood transfusion, this major blood transfusion, and the only person they could get to give him a blood transfusion were the military policeman who was guarding these three Japanese. They took the blood from this military policeman and put into Robbie and gave him this blood transfusion. Nobody would ever came for years afterwards to tell him how he got the blood transfusion, where he got it from. That's just a silly tale, as you mentioned it, but you can cut it out of your tape if you want to. But that's how it was, and I had never had anything to do with Jap prisoner. I never seen a prisoner till I saw those three officers and all these chaps going up into the prison camp. And there it was that I think I had three inspections of them up there, my turn of duty. Three times I inspected them. And each time I had to find a very minor fault, as I was told to. It might have been a dirty eating pan or something like that. But they were put down to work, they were put down and made to pull every bit of grass up around the camp, weed every bit of grass till it was absolutely perfect. That was a job they had to do, given to them by their own officers, to make the camp perfect.